Hello everyone, this is Dick Wamser again, and this will be part two of my autobiography. Today is December the 8th, 2005, about 3:45 in the afternoon. And using essentially the same setup, except I only have one microphone this time, the Sony 105 microphone, which is not quite as noisy when you move it around in your hand, and so I decided to choose that. And then when I put this into the laptop, it comes up in mono with two channels instead of only one channel of stereo as it is as I'm recording it. In fact, let me stop and make an adjustment here. This has two separate volume controls for the microphones, and had the right and left mics wide open, and of course the right mic had nothing in there, so just a bunch of noise coming through, so I shut that off to make it a bit quieter. Anyway, I thank you very much for the comments that I've heard about the first autobiography. I'm not on the email list anymore because it got to be kind of a hectic affair, but I sure enjoyed it while I was there. But I'm teaching three students now, and that plus my own research and my own affairs just didn't give me that much time for email, which is very unfortunate. But we'll talk about that in part three to get you interested in part three before you even hear part two, hopefully. But anyway, I talked last time about the piano tuning school I was attending, and I won't get into too much more about that, except that as many of you did, we had lectures every Friday morning, and I lugged around a Voice of Music Model 720 on open reel recorder to record everything on. And by the time I left the school, I had probably 12 to 14 7-inch reels full at 3 3/4 per track. Most of them were 1200-foot reels. I should say, for those that don't remember that machine very well, it weighed about 40 pounds and was quite heavy. And when you walk 6 or 7 blocks at a time, it does make it very difficult. So I had some fair weather friends who had sometimes carried and sometimes not, depending on their mood. So sometimes we took turns carrying that machine around. And then I headed to my rooming house, of course, about 5 blocks away. So we'd all get together at sometime during the week and listen to the last week's lecture. And I used it to make letter tapes back home and a few other odds and ends, and that's another story that I won't get into. I could probably make a whole biography just on machines alone. Anyway, I graduated in July of 1962, and of course that's a terrible time to get a business going in the summertime, and all the piano teachers are on vacation, and the kids are out of school, and the churches aren't doing anything until Christmas. And there were three other tuners in the area at the time that I started. One of them had been trained in a piano factory and had been tuning ever since about 1925 or so. He was about ready to retire, which is a good point. And then the other one was going full blast, didn't have any more time to pick up anyone new, so it did work out well after a while. And I did my cousin's piano during the summer just to get some practice in. Of course, I had my own piano that I told you about in the last autobiography, so I did that one to keep going. And then I finally got my very first piano tuning. I put ads in local newspapers. We had things like the Thrifty Nickel is today, but it's a very similar situation. We had 4 or 5 of those around, and I put ads in there, and I had business cards printed up and put them in laundromats and other bulletin boards I could find here and there. And it was an old upright piano that needed quite a bit of work, and everything worked out well. I got home and got so excited, I decided to type a letter to my tuning instructor to tell him about my very first job, because he'd had the school open since 1945. And he graduated many and many of students since then, and I was sure he had a folder of the first tuning letters that he would share with other people if it was important enough. So I typed up this letter, and the way that I typed all my letters in those days was, I think Donna Slater mentioned this, doing it in Braille first and then typing it, because otherwise you forget where you left off, the phone rings, or you lose your train of thought, have no idea what you've typed. And so what I used to do was to, let me get the cat off my lap here a minute. Cats and keyboards don't go together well. he doesn't realize that. He's a nice little guy. I got him ticked off at me now. But anyway, this is exactly what I'm talking about. See, at that point, you lose your train of thought when something like that happens. And so unless you have some way of referencing what you do, you're lost. So fortunately, we had a Pika typewriter. And that was exactly the same as a line of Braille would be. So I didn't have any problem, except I wasn't a very good speller. Anyway, I typed this letter, which turned out to be a 3 or 4 page letter, and put it in the mail the next day, and about, oh, maybe 10 days, 2 weeks later, I found out that the man that I was writing to had died of a heart attack the morning before I began my letter. And that was another jolt. And just to jump ahead and backtrack later, the school was a revolving school, which meant that students didn't just come and go at a particular time of the year. There were always students who were just starting out, of the students who had been going for a while, and other students were ready to quit, because they had graduated or gotten to the point they could graduate. And the cat is up on the back of the chair. It's loading up the window. He can enjoy that for a while. Anyway, the students were in a rotating basis, so there were always people coming and going, which was real good because you had a chance to meet a lot of different people that way, and the course was not boring because if you were good at something, you could jump ahead a bit and talk to someone else that had done that part. If you were not too good at something, you could stick behind with the old newer people that just came in and stay with them for a while, so that was great. But when the instructor died, his son, who also was a piano tuner, had a music store in the same town, decided he would at least try to get the Pennsylvania State Department of Public Instruction to acknowledge him as a teacher long enough to get the rest of the students through the course and then close the place down. And he got, of course, involved in paperwork galore to do that, and about the time he was halfway through the paperwork, he had a heart attack too, so I don't even know what happened to all the students that didn't finish their courses, if they got their tuition money back or just how that worked out. But anyway, that was that story. I won't get into the piano tuning business very much because it's essentially like any other business that you work through and work with, ups and downs, happiness and discouragement and that type of thing. A lot of interesting things happened. I will just say one thing about it that you might be interested in, and that is that there is no such thing as increasing your knowledge as in other areas where manufacturers have seminars, manufacturers put out bulletins, manufacturers have places you can go to learn. Now, that when the Japanese took over the piano industry, there was a lot of that going on. But when I first started tuning, and until I suppose about the mid to late 90s, you learn from other people. You never learn from the source. That can be very, very dangerous and sometimes very difficult because you learn what not to do before you learn what you can do. And that's kind of a sad situation, but that's how things work sometimes. And I was able, like many other people, to muddle through doing it that way. I was able to travel and tune at the same time, which came in very, very handy all over the United States. Get some pin money when you're traveling instead of having to rely on your credit card all the time. And even into Scandinavia, which is very, very good as well. That's another story which I can't get into now just because it would be boring to 90% of you. So at that point, then, we'll back up and pull a couple of other threads together. Everybody has a goal in life, or everybody has an event or a situation or a circumstance that really cemented their ability to do whatever they're doing. And this happened to me twice in my life. Of course, religion is a very important part of my life, and I guess you can't get into that without being tarred and feathered, so I'm not going to talk about that either. But that's the primary thing. Nothing can beat that. But in a secular sense, the two things that happened were one time during my junior high school days, we were taught woodworking to a very limited degree. We built birdhouses and other things of that sort, very simple wood objects. But you had to cut things and had to nail them properly so you didn't split the wood, you know, and you had to plane the edges and had to file the edges and make sure that the corners were square and that type of thing. So it was essentially the basics of woodworking. And at the same time this was going on, my uncle was paneling his living room. And I was helping him, quote unquote, as much as I could because, of course, I was an expert. I had a whole 3 or 4 days of woodworking class. And this uncle of mine was a great guy. He is never finished high school, but he was an electrician by trade. But he was a good carpenter. He was a good plumber. He was a good mason. Not the Mason Lodge, but the concrete type of mason. He had common sense coming out of his ears and just an all-around great guy. So he was cutting some trim to put up on the paneling there on the wall. What kind of nail are you using for that? And he said, wait a minute, and I'll show you. So he took this hammer and a scrap of wood and he pounded this nail in it, like that. And and handed it to me. And I couldn't believe it. It was a scrap of wood with an unbelievable shape. I couldn't describe the shape of it. And, of course, it had rough edges and it was all split out. But that nail was smack dab in the middle of that piece of wood, just like you took a ruler and did that. And I just couldn't believe that could happen. How could you take a piece of wood that oddly shaped and just slap a nail right in the middle of it, perfectly straight? You could take that nail between your fingers and spin the wood and it would just balance perfectly because it was right in the middle of that scrap of lumber. And I didn't have any answer for that as to why that could be done, but it really blew me away. And then much, much later, in my early 30s, I came across a person I got quite friendly with who was blinded at the age of 4. And I'm not sure if he brought it up or I just discussed it with him or how the topic came up. But he was also very good at describing things because of his sight that he'd had in the past. And the bottom line was, he said, you know, the only way that you're going to be successful as a blind person is to think like a sighted person does. And the best way to do that is to think in terms of pictures, don't think in terms of words, think in terms of pictures. Like if you see something that you're reading about a green field of grass or a field of green grass, you don't think about this field of green grass as words. Think about the types of grass and the weeds mixed in with the grass and how high the grass is, and are there clover mixed in with the grass, and how long has it been since it was mowed, and is it level or is it up and downhill? Are there flowers with bees buzzing around, or is it just all plain grass? You know, put some information into it. And that's how my uncle was able to take that piece of wood and drive the nail right in the middle of it, because in his mind he pictured that piece of wood as no longer a scrap, but now it meant something because he had to demonstrate with it. He had to make it into a teaching tool. And so that's something I never forgot. And again, I could probably talk about that forever too, but that has been more help than any other thing I could ever think of, other than religion, to get my head on straight and do things properly. And it's not so much whether the picture is accurate. That's nothing to do with it. It's the fact that the picture helps you keep things in your mind, and it helps you remember things, and it helps you utilize a different part of your mind than you normally would do without thinking in terms of pictures. So some of you might like to try that. I think you'll find it's an amazing thing. When I was in high school, I wanted to get a guide dog. And I had written to Seeing Eye about getting a guide dog, and they said no because I didn't need it. I didn't have any place to go, because we lived out in the country. There were no sidewalks anywhere. And I'd have to take a bus and get into Cleveland. Then I could use the dog, but I wouldn't need it to get back and forth to school because I took the bus. And, of course, I didn't have any job to go to after high school because I was taking this piano tuning course, which is what I wanted the guide dog for. But they said, no, you can't have any because you're not needing it for anything. So that was very discouraging. And in 1968, I went to a camp for the blind very close to us called Highbrook Lodge, some of you might be familiar with. And one of the things that happened at that camp was that a guy from Guiding Eyes came up and discussed guide dogs. And I talked to him after he was through speaking because I just always wanted to have a guide dog. I love dogs anyway, and I enjoyed reading about them. Of course, I read Morris Frank's autobiography, and I read the First Lady of the Seeing Eye that was in the 1957 issue of the Reader's Digest. And we'd had dogs our life on the farm, so that was nothing new to me. And I explained what the Seeing Eye situation was, and he said, well, there's no problem with that. He said, if you need a dog and can take care of it, that's all that we need. And he said, just like if you went out and you bought yourself a 35-piece bit set, maybe you won't need a third of those, but you do need some of them. So if you can have use of it and you would take care of it, that's all that we require. So that got me really excited, and when I do things, I research them to death before I even begin to do them. So I started reading every book I could find on guide dogs. I talked to everybody I knew about guide dogs, asked the most ridiculous questions I could ever think of, drove people crazy. And the most amazing statement to me that I got into talking about guide dogs with people was the man that I had known the best. This was about 1969, I imagine. He'd had guide dogs since 1939. And he said, when you go to a guide dog school, you're on vacation. How could you be on vacation? You're working with this animal. It's all new and it's all strange. You're out in the traffic. You're out in the sidewalk. You're out in the escalators and elevators and getting lost in stores. And how could you possibly go on vacation? But any of you who have had a guide dog, except perhaps for Donna Slater, it is a vacation. It's just fantastic. You can't begin to describe it. The book that made the most impression on me was Keep Your Head Up, Mr. Putnam by Peter Putnam. And I think that may still be available. I also read his companion book, Cast Off the Darkness, which is another interesting biography. But anyway, to make the long, long story short, in January of 1970, I went to Guiding Eyes to get my first guide dog. And I've had them for the last 35 years. In fact, it is the last one I just got back in November of 2003. And he's Clayton in the emails that many of you have seen when I send emails out to the list in other places. And that is just an amazing mobility aid as far as I'm personally concerned. I did more with the guide dog than anything else that I had as far as just broadening my horizons is concerned. And again, I could make it five or six part biography to talk about that, but one of the most amazing things, well, there are two amazing things actually. One was that in 1971, I believe it was, either late 70 or 71, I went with a group of other blind people up into Canada. We took a bus, went up through the Thousand Islands up in New York and went to Boston, did some touring up in Boston, and went on to a place in Maine for several days and got by the ocean and had a great time up there. And one time I went to an organ concert up in Montreal, in a big cathedral up in Montreal. And I don't remember the exact name of it now, but it was in the French-speaking area of Quebec, and it was in Montreal, of course. And in order to get to where the organ was, you had to go up four escalators. And at that time, they didn't teach guide dogs how to go on escalators. So I'd actually pick the guide dog up and went up each of these three or four escalators to get to the top where the auditorium was. And that was no problem. And of course, it was a wonderful concert. I enjoyed it thoroughly. And I got out of there and came back down. And I picked up the dog and went down the first escalator. And he got on the floor, and I went to the next one and picked him up and went down the second escalator and I put him down. We got to the third escalator, I picked him up and got to the bottom, I put him down. Got to the fourth escalator and picked him up, and about halfway down he saw the front door and jumped and jumped out of my hand onto the floor, just splat right on the floor and scared everybody half to death. Didn't hurt him at all. So that was great. That's funny to think about. And where he was, another dog I had in 1988 was hit by a car, which at least cracked a rib or two, but the next day she was fine. It was a scary thought because I was at Eugene, Oregon at that time visiting. This was on a Friday evening, and I had to go back home on Monday morning, and I couldn't imagine that guide dog being able to work through the airport after having been suffering the cracked rib and so on. I just let her rest all day on Saturday. Sunday, I took her out to the end of the street, which was not too busy, but there was a traffic light there, and it just shied away from the traffic light completely. I thought, well, that means she doesn't want to work anymore. She's probably done for. But she just was hurting too badly. But Monday morning, she was just as snappy as could be, like nothing had ever gone wrong with her. So that was an astounding thing. In 1984, I had my very first experience with something called a computer. And it blew me away. We have in Cleveland, and still have, in fact, a place called the Cleveland Sight Center. And they have a computer section there that is very, very good. It's probably second class to the NFP place up there in Maryland. And at that time, I went and took the dog. Of course, I had the guide dog at that point and took the bus into Cleveland every Wednesday afternoon and had an appointment there at the Sight Center for 2 hours. And I just couldn't believe it. I was shown the VersaBraille, which just blew me away. How could you put a cassette tape in this machine and get Braille out of it? I just couldn't understand that. But the Apple computer was what I had first gotten involved in. And I was getting a resume together at that time to get the business bigger. And I just couldn't believe how much fun that was. You could put words in and take words out. You could move words around from one place to another. You could spell check, which I could never do before. Just an astounding thing. And the computer was so intuitive. If you were supposed to say something on a floppy disk, it didn't have a disk in the drive, it would tell you that. That's fantastic. So I sure enjoyed that. And I probably should save this for the third part of that biography, and I will get into it more, but I'll just cover this very, very briefly. In 1986, the computer finally got to where it was going to be worthwhile. The MS-DOS machines had come out at that point, and speech was becoming very, very prominent. Not thanks to Larry, because his didn't come out for quite a while after that. This is early 86. There was a man in Columbus that did a program whose name I should remember. Talk.com, I think it was called. Ron Hutchinson was his name. And for those of you who don't go back that far, just imagine a speech software program that was 12K. Okay, that was it, 12K, that's all you had. And you could configure that thing 24 hours a day if you wanted to, not because you had to, but it had so much flexibility that it was an incredible thing. But of course, Larry's beat that all 10 ways to Sunday, but that's another story. And I got involved in it at that point, and I thought, isn't this great? The computer is just ones and zeros. It's right or it's wrong. It's plus or it's minus. It's positive or it's negative. How easy is that going to be to learn the computer inside out, upside down, in three different ways? And of course, you and I know that didn't work out that way. It was very, very frustrating in many, many ways to learn the computer. But MS-DOS, to me, was just the only way for a blind person to compute. Now, Linux, I haven't gotten into that very much. I'd like to someday, just haven't had the time. But for those of you who don't know MS-DOS, I should just draw you an analogy. It's just like if you're going outside a guide with somebody, and they tell you, well, this house is green, and it's got a fairly new car parked in the driveway, and it's got a two-car garage in the back, and looks like an older couple might live there because it's got some heavy furniture in the living room. You know, they describe everything just as much as you want them to. And you get to the intersection, well, it's a one-way street here. The dead end's about five or six houses up. It's very, very short, or whatever else they can tell you about that. And you just rely on that. Any place you want to go, they can take you there and show you exactly what there is to see. as opposed to someone else, it just marches you right along. It doesn't stop for curbs, doesn't stop for nothing, except for traffic lights. That's Windows compared to DOS. I guess that's a terrible explanation, but that'll have to do. And we'll pick that story up in part three of the autobiography and talk more about computers there. I had done some other things beside piano tuning during my career. One thing was it was a company which I won't name, probably not in even existence anymore. But it was very similar to Amway in the way they structured things, except it wasn't quite as professional as Amway. I enjoyed that for about a year, and it gave me a lot more self-confidence than I had in the past, and it was a very, very good thing to do. So I enjoyed that thoroughly. I spoke of Eugene a minute ago. That was 1987 that the dog, his name was Iris, was hit by the car. Went back in 1988, and I was with a church group up there, as I am many times when I go out that way. And we went to see a movie one day in the auditorium where they had everything else going on. And I had met some friends up there that I'd been seeing for the last 3 or 4 years. They lived in a different motel than I was in, so we just met there. And they had seats right up in front for me because not that I could see the picture better. His wife didn't see well, and so they had a good spot up there so she could see better. And we all got to chatting up there, and they got off to do something else, to chat with other people. They had a minute or two before the film started. I just reached down to ruffle Iris's ears and told her what a good dog she was. And a little while later, this lady sat down to talk to me. Had a nice chat. I saw her a day or two later, had another nice chat. The day that we were ready to leave, we went out to eat together, had another nice chat. And then she came over the next afternoon, or the afternoon that we were going to be leaving, had another nice chat. And we started exchanging cassette tapes back and forth. After I got home, I couldn't believe it. I got a You know, you go to a place like that, you say, "I'll write back, give me your address, and I'll write you a letter." And everybody says that. Nobody ever does it. So, of course, we went through that scenario before we left. And so I wasn't expecting anything. A week later, I got this 10-page handwritten letter. And to make that long, long story short, we were married a year later. So it was very nice. And I found out very shortly after we began to get very intimate with each other that she had seen me talking to the dog and thought that's the only person I had to talk to, and said, "That's silly to have that poor man just talking to his dog. I want to go over at least say hello to him." She didn't know I had other people with me. So that was an amazing thing too. We've been very happily married ever since then. And her relatives were out in California, and she had lived in California. So what we did was to send tapes back and forth, and she was much better at it than I was because she had a little micro machine. She'd send me 3 or 4 tapes to my one. And then we would talk on the phone every Friday night for half an hour or so. And then I'd usually call sometimes in the morning a couple of days a week to wake her up because it was a time difference there. So it was like 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning back there for her. And it was 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock here. It was 9 o'clock here and 6 o'clock back there. That's what it was. So I'd get her up and hopefully start her day on the right foot or in the right frame of mind. In March or April, in late April of 1989, I took the Greyhound bus to California, and we wanted to see if we could get the piano tuning business going over there because that's where all the relatives were. I didn't really care much about staying back here in Ohio, where I was living at the time. And I won't make this a real long story, but it was just amazing to look for the answer to that question because we had advertised in the paper for months in advance. And nothing ever came of it. She had found some co-workers because she worked for an insurance company. Some of those people wanted their pianos done. She had some friends and relatives that wanted theirs done. So we had about a dozen to do, which was just enough to pay for the newspaper ad. But anyway, you wonder what's going to happen in a situation like that when you move that far apart. And we had a meeting to go to the last day that I was there. See, she had to get up, like I said, 6 o'clock in the morning to go to this insurance job. This meeting was other piano technicians who get together to kind of sharpen each other's minds and compare notes and, swap war stories and so on. And we would have had to leave her work at 5 o'clock, drive an hour and a half to get to where this meeting was, pay for 2 dinners, and then stay for the meeting, which would have bored her to death, I'm sure. Leave maybe 9 o'clock or 9:30, drive back another 2 hours to get back to Fresno or California where she lived, and then another hour later put me on the bus to get back to Ohio. And we didn't know whether to go or not. How can you start a business if you don't talk to people that are already in the business and don't get your name out to them and start trying to mend some fences and get some information back and forth? And I just didn't want her to do that. That just seemed to me to be a very difficult thing to do because even though building a business is a difficult thing to do, this would be very much out of the ordinary for her to do. And would you believe the evening that we were supposed to do that, she had a drain back up in her apartment and the whole place had 4 inches of water on the floor. So that took care of that answer. So anyway, helped her clean that up, and then we got on the bus at 1 o'clock in the morning to come back here. So we kept on corresponding. And in June of that same year, I went out there again for 2 weeks to visit with her, and then she had pretty much sold everything that she had by then. And what we could bring back on the bus, we did. I think we had 5 or 6 suitcases of her material on the bus. Everything else was sold off. And she came back to Ohio. We lived in Ohio from 1989. Well, I lived there all my life, but she came in 1989 until 1999, about 10 years. And it'll say that for part 3 of the autobiography, I think. But she just hated the snow and cold weather, and I got to the point that I didn't really care for it much anymore. I didn't mind it, but it wasn't something I looked forward to as I had done in the past. When I first got the guide dog, I went into Cleveland purposely and just got off the bus any old place and see if I could figure out how to get back to where I belonged, just, you know, to get more information about getting around and mobility and so on and knowing the city better. And I'd done enough of that for quite a while. And so since she didn't like the cold and snow, and I didn't much care for it either. We moved out here to Oregon, but we'll talk about that on the next part of the autobiography. The hobbies I've had are interesting hobbies in the sense that they have been changed dramatically by technology. I've collected records. That was never been one of my greatest hobbies, but I've done some of that. But it's OTR material I've collected the very most. And I don't know if any of you know a man by the name of Nick James, who used to live in California. He was in Santa Rosa for a while. Was it Santa Rosa? Doesn't sound right. Anyway, in the Los Angeles, basically the Los Angeles area. And when I went out west to my conventions, I'd try to stop and see him once in a while on my way back or on my way up, whichever was easier for him and for me. And he had a literal closet full, a walk-in closet just full of reels of tape. He had like 800 reels of tape he collected over the last 25 to 30 years. And, of course, nowadays you can get a lifetime supply on CD in about a year if you put your mind to it, and that's about what I've got here. I've got so much I'll never listen to it all I know. So that takes kind of the fun out of it when you don't have to collect it. It just kind of falls in your lap by the carload, you know. And you can make copies and don't lose any fidelity. You don't have to worry about the tape speed being right or wrong or whatever. You can always compensate for that digitally, which is a wonderful thing. I've always enjoyed reading, which I still do. And that'll be part of the third part of the autobiography. I love to travel, which I don't do much anymore because my wife doesn't like to drive as much as she used to, and of course you can't very well go by train. There isn't any train to speak of. The bus system is just about shot now as to what it used to be 20 and 30 years ago. And the airplane, of course, is out just because of the expense involved, so I've been kind of staying close to home. Amateur radio doesn't interest me anymore just because there's so many more things to do that are much more immediate. There's no need for the code anymore to speak of, and that was somewhat interesting to me. There's no need for the emergency traffic handling, which would be boring to many people anyway, but that's pretty much fallen by the wayside. So there's no real challenge to that anymore. That just kind of is going away. I enjoy tinkering with things, and again, that has fallen by the wayside, except for the last part of the autobiography, which we'll talk about in terms of how that's been somewhat resurrected. But there again, the tinker aspect is gone. My only trouble was I wanted to do something I'd never done before. I did, what would you say, very basic auto work, changing radiators and water pumps and batteries and, you know, rotating your tires and things of that sort. I've done all those things. But when you've done them, you know you can do it, so why do it? You know, there's no challenge left, so when you do it a few times, it just doesn't really pique your interest anymore, so you don't do it a second time. But so that's not really involved. I don't do any repair work anymore as I used to around the house, you know, installing wiring and putting up doors and things of that sort, putting in window glass. That's just something I don't care about anymore because I've done all that and it doesn't interest me anymore. We will continue on part 3. I'll try to get part 3 done at the same time so I can get these out in the podcast group and have them all put together so it doesn't have to be hanging over my head anymore. Part 3, we'll talk about our move to Oregon, which is a fascinating thing. And we'll talk about what I'm doing now. I'm not doing piano tuning anymore. And we'll talk about the transition of the hobbies that I have. And until we get to part 3 of the autobiography, I'll give you my email address again if you'd like to correspond in some way or other. It's snap, S-N as in Nancy, A-P as in Papa, P as in Papa, at computer, connect.net. So until part three comes up, this is Dick Wamser saying so long for now, and hope that you've enjoyed it.